It is Thursday, September 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Pope Francis is warmly received by the U.S. Congress. More than 700 people are killed in a Hajj stampede outside Mecca. Chinese President Xi Jinping travels to Washington for talks with U.S. President Barack Obama. We'll speak with an analyst.
I think what President Obama will do is tell President Xi that the United States is serious about potentially slapping sanctions on China.
And country's music star Tim McGraw struggles with his voice. It's all ahead. Pope Francis spoke to Congress Thursday, calling on lawmakers and the American people to set aside divisions and to renew a spirit of fraternity and solidarity, cooperating generously for the common good.
You are one responsibility as members of Congress is to enable this country by your legislative activity to grow as a nation. You are the face of its people.
I'm joined now by VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. Well, Cindy, this was quite a speech because Pope Francis is the first pope to ever address a joint session of the U.S. Congress.
Yes, that's right, Sarah, and it has really felt like a very historic day around here. A lot of excitement and less bickering and quarreling, really a sense of lawmakers just being absolutely captivated by this pope known as the Pope of the Poor.
Now, how did Pope Francis implore members of Congress to, because this has been, as everybody knows, a pretty partisan Congress, to try to put aside divisions and work together?
Yes, he did, Sarah. He asked them to, and I think what was a pointed message to this audience, to members of Congress, to avoid polarization and to seek a renewed spirit of cooperation to address the very significant challenges that face this country and the world. He spoke about structural inequality. He spoke about the biggest refugee crisis since the Second World War with refugees and people leaving the Middle East and Northern Africa and going to Europe. And he also pivoted and said people from Latin America are coming north into the United States. And he appealed to lawmakers to see their faces and to see them as human beings and not to be afraid of the numbers. And he said we should not be afraid because most of us were foreigners too at some point.
I watched the speech on television, and some of the key leaders there, when you look at Vice President Joe Biden and Speaker of the House John Boehner, as well as members of the Supreme Court, are themselves Catholic. So this must have been especially meaningful for them.
Yes, it was. House Speaker John Boehner is known for sometimes being emotional, and he absolutely broke out into tears both during the speech and afterwards outside on the West Front balcony. And he said for a little Catholic boy like himself, this was a pretty big deal. He had invited the Pope, and he had invited other popes and had been waiting for this opportunity for 20 years. Vice President Joe Biden is also Catholic, who was seated behind the Pope. So this was a very emotional day for many of the lawmakers. And I must say that they were on their best behavior. They had been asked beforehand not to try to reach out and shake the Pope's hand or to touch him as he walked down the center aisle, and they refrained. And for the most part, they gave him a lot of applause, and there were a number of standing ovations.
Well, it sounds like a very exciting day there on Capitol Hill.
Yes, that's right, and not as much partisanship as we usually see, so we'll see how long that cooperative spirit holds, Sarah.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Cindy. That's Cindy Sain, VOA's congressional correspondent. Well, reaction to the Pope's speech in Congress has been flooding in on Twitter. Michael Lippin has been looking at that for us. So, Michael, what are some of the top tweets that you've been reading?
Hi, Sarah. Well, Pope Francis addressed so many important issues to Americans in his speech that many people have been highlighting the comments that they like. I'll start with a few Twitter accounts from the U.S. political world. How about the White House? Well, @WhiteHouse highlighted this line from the pontiff. As the son of an immigrant, I'm happy to be a guest in this country, which was largely built by such families. Now, the White House likely chose to promote that line from the Pope's speech because it's taken a relatively liberal approach to the immigration dispute in the United States. Last November, you may recall that President Obama took some executive actions to protect almost 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation. Now, one of the many U.S. lawmakers tweeting about the Pope's speech is Democratic House Representative Keith Ellison, who is at Keith Ellison. He said, Let's answer Pontifex's call to action by addressing the issues of economic, climate, and social justice. Now, Pontifex, for those who don't know, is the Pope's English Twitter handle. Well, today was also a special day for Catholic members of Congress, as Cindy Sain was mentioning just now. Among those is House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. She's at Nancy Pelosi, and this is what she tweeted. Pontifex's address was extraordinary. Day of profound joy.
Michael, what lines from the Pope's speech are being highlighted by the U.S. media?
Well, I was looking at the Wall Street Journal's Twitter handle, at WSJ, and they mentioned this line from Pope Francis on politics. A good political leader is one who, with the interests of all in mind, seizes the moment in a spirit of openness and pragmatism. Well, online news site Slate was one of many live-tweeting the Pope's remarks. It noted that the Pope made a shout-out to capitalism, as in saying something positive about it. And that line from the Pope was this. Part of the effort to fight poverty is creation of wealth. Well, follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE, and you'll find a link where you can see more of Slate's real-time reactions to the speech. Sarah?
Thank you very much. That is VOA's Michael Lippin. A stampede on the outskirts of the holy city of Mecca in Saudi Arabia left at least 717 people dead and more than 800 injured. It's the deadliest tragedy to strike the annual Hajj pilgrimage in a quarter century. I'm joined now by commentator and writer Salman Al-Ansari. Mr. Al-Ansari, you know, this, of course, information about this incident is still coming in, but why are these stampedes repeatedly occurring in MENA during the pilgrimage rituals?
Yeah, hi, Sarah. Yeah, this was actually a very tragic incident that happened. And I believe that it's like more into like a domino effect, like some groups of the pilgrims decided to go against the flow, then we would be having this kind of tragic incident where people, specifically old people, would get on the ground and like, you know, like it's almost like one of the biggest gathering in the world, where you have like around 2 million people in one spot. So I think it's I'm not gonna say that it's predictable, but it's definitely an issue that has been faced in so many years. But this year was like the hardest. I'm pretty sure that there are a lot of measures that will be taken for in the future for like minimizing this kind of incident, because this one is really tragic and everyone is sad about it. And we've read the reports that there were around 100,000 guards that have been like from the National Guard, from the forces, from the Saudi forces, were actually on the ground and were trying to control the flow of the pilgrims and the people there. But definitely with this huge number of people.
Yeah, well, now you mentioned rituals. Apparently, after repeated losses of lives in these stampedes, Saudi Arabia reconstructed the site where pilgrims throw rocks at pillars representing the devil, and established sort of one-way pass to the site. But the, you know, the stampede happened again.
Yeah, it's actually like true that it happened, but it's never happened with this toll, with this big number. Like beforehand, definitely we had like some sometime like in 1998, 118 people died, and it was like a very tragic and very a big incident that happened. And also, like beforehand in 1994, but like afterwards, it's just in the right way for a long time. So it's not something that we are speaking about as if it repeatedly happens with the same toll, with the same big amount, etc. But definitely, Saudi Arabia is taking every measure to put the controls and stuff.
Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Sarah.
That's Saudi commentator and blogger Salman Al Ansari. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists have discovered a new species of duck-billed dinosaur that made their home in northern Alaska some 69 million years ago, toward the end of the Cretaceous period. They were the northernmost dinosaurs to have lived during the so-called Age of Dinosaurs. The researchers call these polar dinosaurs Ugrunulakukpikensis, which means ancient grazer. The species grew to a length of about 9 meters, roamed the Arctic in herds, and lived on a diet of hardy Arctic vegetation. With hundreds of teeth, they were well equipped to eat their tough textured food. Although the climate in the Arctic then was much warmer than it is today, the dinosaurs still had to cope with months of winter darkness and snow since they lived so far up in the north. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country music singer Tim McGraw struggles with his voice. Chinese President Xi Jinping faces potentially difficult discussions with U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House Friday on cybersecurity, maritime tensions, and human rights. And this is his first state visit to the United States. China expert Bonnie Glazer of the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the status of bilateral relations between the world's two largest economies are complicated. Some analysts believe recent revelations of likely Chinese hacking of government and corporate hacking will dominate the discussions. Glazer says this is not a new issue. The two leaders discussed the matter at the meeting at Sunnylands in California in June 2013 and last November in Beijing.
I think what President Obama will do is tell President Xi that the United States is serious about potentially slapping sanctions on China. If in the future the U.S. has more evidence that China is stealing trade secrets from American companies, I think that this information will be shared with Beijing. And if the Chinese government does not prosecute the company or individuals who are responsible, then I think that there will be the imposition of sanctions. And I think this is the message that Obama is going to convey.
In Seattle, one of the officials traveling with the president indicated that there might be some sort of cyber warfare agreement, a code of conduct, if you will, reached during this state visit. How likely do you think that might be?
Well, there have been reports of the possibility that the two countries will sign an agreement where they will not target each other's critical infrastructure. So that means, for example, electrical grids, maybe large water sources. I'm not so certain. There was a background briefing that was given by very senior administration officials, and that suggests that the expectations are not very high for such an agreement. But there's another possibility, and that is the establishment of a higher-level dialogue mechanism on cyber issues. But one of the problems with the existing mechanism is that it's very low level. It's run by Foreign Ministry and State Department, which, of course, on the Chinese side, the Foreign Ministry is very little clout. And it's very difficult to coordinate all the different parts of the system. Another problem is that since the United States indicted 5 PLA officers, the Chinese have suspended the talks. And so we don't have an effective dialogue mechanism. So creating a new one and making it higher level at least holds out the promise of making some progress on this issue in the future.
In remarks at Georgetown University earlier this week, National Security Advisor Susan Rice suggested that the U.S. will not be intimidated by territorial ambitions by China in the South China Sea.
Yes, the administration is talking tough on the South China Sea. That has been going on for quite some time. The rhetoric perhaps has gotten a little bit sharper this year and in recent months. But the administration really is not doing very much in action. There have been reports ever since May that the Obama administration is considering conducting freedom of navigation operations by sending either aircraft or ships into the 12 nautical miles around an artificial island that used to be a submerged reef over which no country could actually have sovereignty and therefore has no entitlement to a territorial sea around it. But we have not seen that happen. Indeed, in hearings last week at the Senate Armed Services Committee, the Defense Department's Assistant Secretary of Defense, David Scheer, confirmed that the United States has not sailed within those waters since 2012. So again, growing pressure on the administration to do more than just talk tough.
That's Bonnie Glazer of the Centers for Strategic and International Studies. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Country music star Tim McGraw can't sing. That's not an editorial comment, but a medical one. McGraw's had to cancel the last two shows of his current Shotgun Rider tour because of vocal distress. International Edition's Pete Heinlein talked with VOA Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about McGraw's condition, which is similar to one which sidelined several top acts, including Little Big Town, Kelly Clarkson, Sam Smith, and Meghan Trainor.
Nikki, what's the story here?
Yeah, Tim McGraw's been added to the list. It's interesting. He's been on his Shotgun Rider tour since June, and it's been taking a toll on his vocal cords. Lucky for him, he doesn't have to have surgery. But the doctor has mandated that he cancels his last two tour dates. So he's been nonstop, but apparently he can't finish it. Not according to doctor's orders. He must rest. So the last two shows have been canceled. Hopefully they will be rescheduled sometime soon.
Boy, that's a tough one for us country music fans, especially.
Yeah. You know, I think that a lot of people, the industry really has to reevaluate its approach to touring. Because a lot of these artists, they're singing. They're not making money off of album sales, so they have to tour. That's how they're making the majority of their money. And they're doing like hour sets or 90-minute long sets. And they're taxing their vocals because they're doing these sets consecutively. Like, they're not getting the proper rest. If they smoke or drink at all, that also impacts their vocal cords.
And they do.
Yes, of course. Even if it's a glass of wine, it still does stress the vocal cords when you are singing that intensely on the road. And there is the incentive to just keep going, because there's so much money riding on these tours.
We could have a little double wide planet in an empty field. We could have a big old white picket wrap around on a hill. Don't make a difference to me, baby, where the wind takes me, long as I'm with you, girl. We could have something or nothing, still be sitting on top of the world.
What's happening? I mean, Tim McGraw was here in town a couple of weeks ago and did a really phenomenal show.
Yeah.
What are the rest of his fans who are holding tickets? What happens to them?
Well, you know, it's a bummer for everybody involved. They haven't said when they're going to reschedule those dates. And I still think in the grand scheme of things, like Little Big Town had to cancel several weeks worth of shows. And his is just the last two shows of his final tour. So I think, you know, it's a bummer for everybody because people have to reschedule as far as artists and as well as the venue and everybody who's involved in making this show phenomenal as it is.
We remember how Adele came on the scene with that fantastic full voice.
Yeah.
And then she's gone.
Yes.
I mean, can she come back? I mean,
she's actually her new album is set to drop fairly soon at the end of this year. So she has recovered fairly well. But, you know, it's an excellent point. There's so much pressure on these artists to keep producing. So not only are they touring, but a lot of them are recording their albums while they are touring. So that even makes it worse. But as far as Adele is concerned, she took a break. She had her vocal surgery, and she's coming back this year. And Tim McGraw as well is getting ready to drop his next album, November 6th, called Damn Country Music.
Nikki Strong, always a pleasure to have you here. You can catch Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach out to Nikki on Twitter at VOA_music. Thank you so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
Like we got love. Sitting on top of the world.
The music of Tim McGraw. Well, that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, as required by law, the President of the United States informs the Congress which countries produce illicit drugs or serve as transit points. But that does not mean that their governments are not making a substantial effort to rectify the situation or that they are not cooperating with the United States and other nations to control the production and flow of illegal drugs. It just means that due to a combination of geographic, commercial, political, and economic factors, those who produce or smuggle narcotics deem these countries to be convenient for the operation of their nefarious trade. Of the 22 countries that made this year's list, 17 are in Latin America. Though Bolivia and Venezuela did not make meaningful efforts to meet their obligations to international counter-narcotics agreements over the past year, four Latin American countries made commendable progress. Last year, about 86% of cocaine destined for the United States moved through seven countries in Central America. The remaining 14% traveled through the Caribbean. Mexico, working with the United States through the Merida Initiative, made headway toward breaking the power and impunity of transnational criminal organizations, strengthening border controls and law enforcement, and improving the capacity of its judicial system to investigate and prosecute drug cases. In the Caribbean, Haiti took advantage of U.S. technical assistance and financial support to strengthen its police brigade in the fight against narcotics trafficking. Summoning considerable political will, Haiti's government stood up to criminal organizations, improved its counter-narcotics capability, beefed up its maritime interdiction, allowing it to start seizing drug shipments, and last year passed a law criminalizing public corruption, which goes hand in hand with the illicit drug trade. In South America, Colombia and Peru, countries that struggle with large-scale drug production, have been successful in seizing numerous large shipments of cocaine. Peru developed alternative livelihoods for farmers previously dependent on illicit cultivation, while Colombia's eradication efforts helped reduce coca cultivation by 52% in 5 years. Illicit drugs are destructive to people and society. The United States will continue to expand and enhance collaborative counter-narcotics and anti-crime partnerships to eradicate them globally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.